Think for a moment of what you have stored on your computer. I don't even know everything I've got on my computer. Maybe you have some valuable photos from important family occasions or maybe once-in-a-lifetime trips. Maybe it's financial information that you'll need for tax purposes. Now think about what it would mean if it all went poof, if it all disappeared. Oh, that's scary, isn't it? Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. Peter Green is an independent computer consultant, provides great information and resources at Infostar.com, and he's going to share some really great information about backup options and how to choose the right one. He's joining us by phone because of some recent back surgery, and Peter, great to have you with us as always.
Always great, Larry. Glad to be up and around. Running. Running or doing calisthenics yet.
How's the back's getting better, though, I hope.
It's on the mend.
Well, wonderful. I remember, and this is quite a few years back, you told me this story, and you didn't tell me the company, and it's been so many years ago. I remember you getting a call from a company, and the boss was on vacation. And someone in the company had accidentally erased or lost all of their financial information for the year, and they were desperate for you to find it before the boss got back.
Yep, yeah, that happens.
And you found it.
Yep, and there are tools to do to do recovery, but there are also tools that you can pre-plan, you know, against disaster. So there are differences.
Yeah. Well, thinking about that, backup is so important. It's certainly something you've talked about many times on the show. And what items should we be backing up regularly?
What items to back up regularly? Anything that you feel is precious to you.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess, yeah.
And the thing is that some people don't even realize what's actually precious. Simple things like email settings, because a lot of people take this stuff for granted. FTP internet connections, that have secure passwords. Once you set it up, it's kind of like you're just using it over and over, and sometimes you put it on autopilot, and then when it isn't there again, unless you've kept good records, a backup's going to get you out of a bind pretty fast.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're going to go back to your paper trail. I use my, for a lot of people, I think the phone has become a great secondary backup in terms of taking pictures of things.
Yeah.
I will take pictures of screens of computers.
Yeah.
To help me, I will take pictures of products when I'm out looking for things. That just saves time and, where to find the information. But in terms of, backing up your system, if you're just, alone, it's just you, are you using, is your music backed up, your pictures, videos, bookkeeping files, tax information.
What about computer programs? Do we need to back those up? People ask about that all the time.
Yeah, the thing with programs, it's an interesting question. If you buy the original, that proves that you own the license. So you really need to have some kind of proof, whether or not you produce a receipt or, the first download of the file, because a lot of times there are updates over and over and over again. But if you have to redo it on a new machine, you have to pick a starting point. So typically what happens is you have to reinstall the original program, and then you go through a series of updates and upgrades to bring your program back up to speed. So you could go back to the company and say, can I get a new image of the software so I don't have to go back and update and upgrade the program for, the last 2 or 3 years. Some manufacturers will do that, and others, it just depends on the software. Some make it like the update or upgrade is one huge file, and you're already current, versus they give you little bits and pieces, and you may have to do it 5 or 6 times.
Yeah. You think back, we had all that physical hardware like floppy disks and then CDs, and then we had the external hard drive or the thumb drive, and now there are options that are in the cloud, so to speak, And people have asked me, what is the cloud anyway?
Well, the cloud's just basically online to an internet web service where you typically will use your web browser to log into the account. And, basically the things are, is it secure? Is the service reliable? And is it easy to use? If it's by you or if you're doing it for your company, how much time and effort does it take to figure it out to get it going? But there's so many other issues that you have to factor in terms of how much storage do you need? How does that affect the cost and the length of the commitment for the contract? Are you going to do it month by month? Which is, you can do it month by month and feel it out and see how it goes, or if you think it's good enough and you're happy, you can make a longer commitment, which saves money. How often are you going to do the backups? Is it something you do once a day, once a week, a couple of times a day? And then your internet connection speed. If you got a dial-up connection and you've got gigabytes of data, you've got a problem.
Yeah.
Because you're trying to, push something up to the internet that's through a very small, connection, and you've got a lot of data, you're going to choke your internet connection.
Yeah.
And then, from a company standpoint, how many users? Is it one person doing it for everybody, or do you have certain, groups or clusters of users where they need their own access and their own controls? How many different devices or workstations? For example, our smartphones, some people may not even realize it until they run into the issue of a backup, where your backup on an iPhone, you can back up to Apple's cloud service, and I highly recommend that, but there's a limitation to how much they give you at no cost. Same with other, Android phones. They also give you cloud service for backup, but, there's a limitation to how much space. So, are you going to back up your contacts and your messages and your calendar? What happens when you start adding your pictures and your music and so forth? That'll probably take you over the top. And then if you've got mixed operating systems, do you have software that will work on all the operating systems that you're trying to back up?
Yeah.
So those are all questions that, depending on who you are and your business, you have to ask yourself. And then the other thing that you should be doing is network attack storage, or NAS. And some newer routers, like within the last couple of years, have added that, where you just simply attach a storage device onto the router. But that's internal. So, cloud is off-site, and the network attached storage or an attached hard drive is localized.
Yeah.
So the biggest thing about the cloud service or any of these off-site services is that you're getting your data securely off-site. So
yeah.
If something happens locally, you have an alternative.
If the building burns down, you're not out.
Right. And the thumb drives have increased a lot in size, and for some people, a large thumb drive works fine, and you back it up and take it with you.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. And for some people, even myself included, a lot of the times it's nice to have something that you can actually put your fingers around and stick in your pocket as opposed to the cloud.
Yep, I do that all the time. It's a very comforting. It's like a boo-boo.
Yeah. So there's lots of things to consider, and there are free options out there for cloud backup, so that's nice.
Yeah, there's a lot of services out there that will give you 2 to 5 gigabytes of storage for free. For some people, that's plenty. And, like I said, with Apple, they give you 5 gigabytes of storage. But when you start factoring in all the different things that you do, the files grow in size. They add up quickly.
Yep. Well, we have some callers online with questions for you, but there are open lines, so I want to let people know that. If you have a question for Peter Green today as we talk computers and software with him, I hope you'll join us. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can post a question on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, or email us at talk@wpr.org. Laura in Minocqua has been waiting a while here, so let's give her a chance. Laura, hi. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. My question is about an issue I've had for the last 3 or 4 weeks, and what I noticed was up on the URL that the when I'm on a secure site, signed in my little padlock that says verified by VeriSign, will intermittently, the padlock turns into a triangle with an exclamation point in the center. So I immediately get out of there, and I'm a long-time listener, so I'm very diligent about using SpyBot and CCleaner and cleaning my browser and running my backups and scans and so forth. I sort of investigated what that was. The most I could find out was it was saying on Firefox's customer service that it indicates the website does not supply identity info. And when I'm on Yahoo, or, for instance, I went to InfoStar and was trying to get some online scans to make sure there wasn't anything on my computer, when I clicked on Avast, for instance, that little padlock, again, would change to this triangle. So I feel like there's something going on, and I don't really know what to do. I don't know what else to do to try and get rid of it, or is it something? And just to say, I am on dial-up, and I don't know if the speed has something to do, because it says something about the just that there are images coming through that are not verified, not necessarily the website. Hmm. So that's sort of my question.
All right. Well, what do you got to say, Pete?
It is possible the internet speed could be an issue in terms of trying to sync up with all the different things that the web pages are throwing at us today as users. I haven't seen I haven't really taken notice of that triangular symbol with exclamation that you're referring to. But the key thing when you're on a website, if you're in a secure website and that padlock is, you know, it's the key or the padlock is secure, you shouldn't have an issue with using the site. If you're in an unsecure portion of their website where security is not really necessary, in other words, you're not really logged in as a user, but simply on the site and looking around, I wouldn't be concerned about, you know, security issues with that.
Right, and that is what, for instance, if I'm signed into Yahoo to look at my email, I want to make sure that's secure.
Right.
And it can be, I can open 2 emails and it's fine, just nothing crazy graphics-wise. But right. Then the third one I'll open, then that padlock will go away, and that's what bothers me. I'm signed in, and it's just sort of a weird intermittent. And then I'll get out of Yahoo, and 2 hours later I can get in there. It doesn't happen at all the next morning. You know, so it's just this sort of in and out.
Hit and miss.
I don't know what else to do. Like I've, you know, said, I've gone on your website plenty of times to get online scan info and stuff like that. So
right.
I just wonder if there was anything else you would recommend that I should just try. And if it's a speed thing, I can just live with it. But I...
Yeah. Yeah. All right. What do you think, Pete?
I would try, Yahoo is a web access based email, and it should be secure when you're on it. There should be some means for you to click through to Yahoo to just, you know, inquire about that. And I would also probably take a look at their user forums. They usually have some kind of support forums for their users. And you could probably, you know, key in or query a question in that form is related to that. And there may already be information posted on that, because I'm probably going to guarantee that you're not the first person that's seen that.
No, probably not.
And Laura, that's where I would look for that answer, is I would start with the Yahoo user tech forums. I don't know the link to that, but I can guarantee you one exists.
Yeah.
And you could do a Yahoo search, or you could do a Google search, and you'd probably find it.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Laura, for calling. Appreciate your call. Our guest today, Peter Green of InfoStar.com, regular guest here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to everybody who contributed during our spring membership drive, by the way. We had more than 2,600 listeners pledge, including almost 700 sustaining pledges, and we're pleased to welcome 565 new members to Wisconsin Public Radio. How much was donated? Well, you all donated over $344,000 to fund Wisconsin Public Radio programs. So thank you very much. And One of those programs, by the way, coming up at 2, we're going to have, talk about Pete Seeger coming up at 2 today. May 3rd would have been Pete Seeger's 95th birthday. Kathleen Dunn celebrates the life and legacy of that great American folk singer and activist with local legend and music historian Bill Malone. That's coming up at 2 here on the Ideas Network. Right now, though, talking with Peter Green about backing up valuable data and other cloud computing questions with him. You can join us at 800-642-1234. And Jim in Green Bay online with a question for you, Pete. Hi, Jim. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. Pete, about a week ago, I had a strange thing happen with my Yahoo email, and I have a feeling that it has something to do with that, well, I don't know if it's really a virus, it's called Heartbleed.
Okay.
All of a sudden, on my email, I start seeing these right at the top of my inbox, like an email message, and it has a little dollar sign on it, and it's an ad. The thing of it is, you can't get rid of it. You can't delete it because if you click on that dollar sign, it freezes up your delete button. Is this something to do with Heartbleed?
I don't know all the specific details about the Heartbleed virus. I haven't personally experienced it, which I'm glad.
Yeah.
But what when I usually am confronted with things that I haven't seen before, or if you want to call them computer symptoms or issues, I usually start doing searches on what I'm seeing, and you can typically find a trail of, you know, where does it come from? Where is it originating? It may, you know, something with Heartbleed was a compromise of an SSL certificate. And that would mean that it would require you to have acted on something with the Yahoo SSL certificate to render it.
What is that SSL certificate?
It's a secure socket layer where it's basically creating like a barrier to, or like a guarantee that Yahoo is who it says it is.
Ah.
So when you have a website that is doing e-commerce, you either have your own SSL certificate or you're sharing an SSL certificate from the website vendor, the hosting company, which can save you money from an e-commerce standpoint, you know, for a smaller company.
Yeah.
But when you have your own SSL certificate, it's basically research that has been done by the web hosting company or a third party that you say who you are, and they're saying, yeah, we've talked to this company, someone there physically. It exists at its place that it's specified where the bricks and mortar is, and they then authorize a SSL certificate to be valid for a period of time, typically 1 or 2 years. So that, you know, that's an important process to go through, but it's not it may cost like $100 to $200. A shared SSL certificate is really a web hosting company guaranteeing that the site that you're on as a consumer, you can be okay about buying something from it because it's secure. It's an authorized e-commerce site. So it's a little bit different, but the concept is that you're buying from somebody that is valid. So in terms of what you're seeing with the Yahoo email and associating it with Heartbleed, you know, I would probably look into, you know, what those, you know, the dollar sign and the lack of functionality of the delete key, you know, what that means and where that's coming from before I would, you know, go to the conclusion that it's created from a virus.
Would it have anything, just before this happened, when I went into my email, I got this message saying that I could no longer have a compatibility view of my email. and I had to turn my compatibility view off. And that's what I start getting this weird email.
Yeah, that's possible. You know, if you go, I mean, I would go back if you can switch it and, you know, see what the difference is. Because when you make changes to any kind of settings in, you know, especially in a web-based email system, it changes the functionality of the environment. You know, the whole one little thing can make things look different. It can make it behave different. And there's usually many options that you can change in there. Most people use the default because that's when they first see it, that's what they get. And they usually don't look under the hood in terms of preferences and things like that. Not sure why you got asked that question, though, to change it.
Well, it wasn't a question. It indicated that it would not let me into my email box inbox unless I switched off my compatibility view. By the way, I'm running Excel. And I know Excel is no longer being supported, so I don't know if that's a problem.
Yeah. When a program is no longer supported, that can be an issue too.
Yeah.
I would inquire about, you know, why that changed. You know, there's got to be a purpose for that change. It could be, you know, I would also maybe try a different web browser and see how it reacts with that.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, it's another good thing to do. Jim, good luck. Appreciate your call, and give us a report when you find something additional out here from your searching. I want to give Stella in Sturgeon Bay a chance to join us. Stella, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I want to raise the point that in discussions that I have heard, multiple discussions of storing data in the, quote, cloud, I have yet to hear any discussion of the ecological costs of this, environmental ecological costs of the cloud. The cloud is not a cloud up in the sky. It's not a benign thing. It is multiple football field-sized warehouses that have banks and banks and banks and that are filled, literally, with banks of computers that are all consuming massive amounts of electricity, and even more massive amounts of electricity are being consumed by the air conditioning that runs 24/7 in order to keep them cool so that they will keep functioning. So I think when we're talking about the costs of the cloud, we really need to consider that from our senator, our deceased former Senator Gaylord Nelson, he raised the point, he made the point that the economy is a wholly owned subsidiary of the environment. And we really need to, when we make decisions like this, we really need to take into consideration the environmental impacts of what we're doing.
Pete, thank you for calling, Stella. Pete, a comment from you.
Yeah, I agree with that. All those are real issues, and I know some companies are very proactive with their computer farms in terms of trying to be, energy use conscious, incorporating photovoltaic fields to, you know, help provide, you know, power at, you know, not only more cost effective, but, you know, alternative forms of energy. One of my top 10 sites talks about, the power of wind. And there are companies that are trying to harness wind power. So I think, and those are high technology companies that will probably, you know, hopefully in the future partner up, you know, to keep those kind of costs down and the ecological impact of, larger and larger computer farms. But The one thing that's probably not going to go away is the popularity of the internet and the web and how we use that to communicate and provide services and sell products and so forth. The large companies like Google, Yahoo, Microsoft, a company like Microsoft, which has a very popular Office program, now sells their software basically leased online through, an online service versus you loading it locally. And, you know, they're are a lot of alternatives to use these products and services in the cloud, and they have to be powered somehow. So, you know, to look under the hood, you know, it's how are those companies, you know, being, you know, ecologically conscious and, you know, positive towards the environment. That as a consumer, you have to do individually and make your decision.
And thanks again for calling. I appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. Mike in Eau Claire has a question for you. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Yeah, I'm on my Yahoo email right now, and this is in reference to that a few calls ago where he thought he had a virus on his email. I mean, Yahoo is it's a free email service, and, I mean, they have to pay the bills, and that's just an ad. I mean, I'm looking at that right now, and on the top of my email, it's from pearls.com. I see the little dollar sign. I click on it. It just takes me over to pearls.com because they want me to buy something because, I mean, you know, Yahoo email is a free service, and they have to pay their bills somehow, so I guess that means that they're going to show an ad on the top of my email bar, and I can just choose to ignore it, and that's exactly what I'm doing. So,
right.
I mean, that's all that really is. I mean, it's just, you know,
yeah,
they got to make some money, too. So, I mean, it's a free email service,
yeah,
so I don't think he has to worry. There's no virus or anything on his computer or in his email. It's just an ad.
All right.
I'm a Gmail user, so I don't I haven't looked at a Yahoo email account in quite a while. So they're all a little different.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's good points, Mike. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank
appreciate you. The call. We had Bob wondering, what do you suggest as a replacement program for XP? We talked about XP a little earlier. He said, I hear that Linux is worth looking at. Is there a Linux version that's similar in appearance and without the major learning curve?
So what's the replacement for Windows XP? Boy, the way I look at that is, what are you using your computer for? You know, what are your goals, objectives? You've been using the computer, using it for bookkeeping, using it for email, using it for getting online and doing research and using the web and social media. Are you doing spreadsheet work? Are you writing a book? Are you doing, you know, taking a lot of pictures? Are you a music person, you know, with a lot of songs and artists and things like that? To me, if you're going to look at replacing XP right now, and it's just you, I would probably look at some kind of Apple product and keep it simple. You know, like an Apple Mini.
Yeah.
And you attach a monitor to it, you know, whatever size you want, and you can use their cloud service to do backup if that's enough, or a USB drive. And, you know, and the other question, how much do you have to invest? You know, is it $300, $500, $1,000? Do you want it to be portable? And then, you know, the Linux, the Ubuntu alternative, if what you're doing is, like I said, email and getting online and maybe doing some document work, and, you know, there are programs out there that are supported on that. And you could probably find some local user groups that, you know, can get you started with it. But the mainstream products out there are Windows-based and Apple-based. So, you know, what is your comfort zone in terms of, you know, using a computer and seeking help? So,
yep, there you go. Just on another topic that we were talking about earlier here, a caller suggested an old-fashioned paper Rolodex to keep track of passwords. You know, there's nothing, you know, that can work too.
Yeah.
Especially if you've got them in two of them and in different places.
I used to actually keep little notebooks, very tiny notebooks with my information, but I haven't done that in years. Relying more on the phone and the cloud backup for that.
Well, speaking of phones, I think Jeff and Beloit has a question for you relating to phones. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Hey, my question is about my computer online activity in the past has been with a home computer, a laptop, and now I no longer have internet service, and I wanted to switch to an iPhone for that sort of thing. I'm not sure how many gigs to get, and I'm wanting to know what your guests might say about the difference between Apple and Android, and as far as that goes. So I guess basically that's my question.
Uh-huh.
Oh, and so maybe sorry, go ahead.
So are you looking at using your phone to be your internet connection for just through the phone, or are you looking at hooking it up to another, like a laptop to or tablet to allow you to use the internet that way?
Well, I just heard you mention an Apple Mini, and I had thought about something like that versus an Apple 5S iPhone.
Right.
I wouldn't go any larger than the Apple Mini. That's about as big of anything device I'd like to carry around with me. But I do understand that they can be used as a phone.
So you're talking about like an Apple Mini iPad. That's what you're referring to, it sounds like.
But that you can use as something you can use as a phone as well.
I don't know. I don't think the Mini you can use as a phone unless, the market is the iPhone is their communication device. You can get on the internet if you have a Mini that is Wi-Fi enabled and could be, or you buy a service to hook it up to the internet. Same thing with an iPad. The Mini I was referring to is their like an entry level desktop system. So it's like it's just a small device that plugs in. But again, you need internet access to be able to get onto the internet. So if you're looking at, you know, like an iPhone to be your main source of internet connectivity, the important or an Android phone, you know, the most important thing is where are you located and what kind of services are available to you. So if you have, you know, the option of Verizon, T-Mobile, AT&T, U.S. Cellular, Sprint, and so forth, is to find out what is your connectivity speed with each one of those vendors in your area and how reliable it is. You know, the 4G, you know, speed on the internet with a smartphone, there are very, you know, very high speed connections, but is it available in the area where you're trying to get that service? And then the alternative is to buy an add-on to that service where you could have an Apple Mini or a tablet from another manufacturer or a laptop and enable that device through your internet provider so that you can get onto the internet with that as well. And that's called tethering. Or a Wi-Fi hotspot. You basically use your phone as a Wi-Fi hotspot.
And how many gigabytes would I be looking at, you know, for what would you recommend?
You mean as far as storage? Usually, every time I've gotten one of the iPhone devices, I've usually gone to the higher end. So if they offer, you know, if they had an 8 or a 16, I'd go to the 16. If they had a 16 or a 32 gig, I'd opt to go to the 32. The iDevices by Apple are typically locked in stone, so you can't expand them. Some of the Android devices you're able to, where they allow you to add extra memory cards. So it just depends on the product. But, you know, going higher rather than, you know, entry level or smaller is usually the better choice in the long run.
Yeah. Thanks, Jeff. Appreciate the call. Carolyn Kenosha. Yeah, I'm sorry. You were going to say something else, Pete?
No, I just said good luck.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of things to consider.
Carolyn Kenosha, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hello, Larry. A few moments ago, you touched on my exact problem. Unfortunately, 10 days ago, my computer expert bachelor's son passed away very suddenly.
Oh.
And we are at a total loss. Everything was in his computer. We don't even know where to start right now. I'm thinking, how do we hire a hacker? And my plea is to other listeners, that please have something like this little notebook or something that we can find, that the family can find, with your passwords.
Oh.
We have no idea what to do.
Wow.
We're finding very little on paper. He probably encrypted his passwords, whatever that means. I'm the Luddite mom. Mm. That was forever saying to him, Bruce English, please, this is Luddite mom here. He does have a brother who is computer literate and has a lot on the computer, but not to the extent that Bruce did. But we don't even know where to start. Is there any advice for what we have to do?
So is this a family member or the person at work?
My son, yeah.
It's her son that passed away.
This is my son, and he was an expert computer programmer.
Okay.
I'm sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
Yeah, it shouldn't be that way. There are programs that allow you to redo the password on computers. So in other words, if you want to call it hacking in, there is software out there that basically allows you to reboot a system and reset the password to get into the operating system as a user so that you can get on the computer. So if he's got a computer that you're telling me is locked down and you can't get into, that can be bypassed.
And the son, your other son, should know how to do that.
Well, he may or may not.
Well, he does. No, he doesn't.
Oh, okay.
All right. Well, on my website, there are links to resources that allow you to do that. And
okay.
I'll see if I can point them out to you now, because I'm going to use an iPad to get onto it. What you can do is point him to these links, and if you go to the Virus Info Center, go to infostar.com, and then go to the Virus Info
Star.
Infostar.com.
Okay.
And go to on the top left side, you'll see Virus Info Center.
Okay.
And I would say in the top third of the page, there's going to be links. It's going to say, let's see, which one would I use? There are security.
Now, is this on your website?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so how do I tell my son to get to that, to get to you?
That's the infostar.com.
That is Infostar. Okay.
Yep. And then...
Luddite mom here.
That's all right.
Okay. All right. And then, like I said, the Virus Info Center page is on the top left, and you click on that, and there are two areas. There's security utilities and emergency utilities.
Okay.
And... there's a password editor, and there's also another one called EBCD. And I know those two are programs that can be used to redo the passwords on Windows systems.
So once he gets to, he should be, if he's computer literate, he's gonna be able to.
Yeah.
He's going to be able to circumvent that. Again, I'm sorry for your loss, Carolyn.
Now, if you want, you can, I think, Larry, this is possible. She could hang on and talk to Judith, and Judith can give her my phone number.
Okay, Judith, she's tied up right now with something else, and I'm not sure she's going to be able to do that.
Well, it's on my webpage, too, so she can just go at the bottom of my webpage. If she needs to, you can call me.
Oh, okay. Go to infostar.com and then look the number up there. Okay. That makes sense. Good luck.
Wonderful.
Yeah, thanks, Carol. Thank you for calling.
Yep, good luck.
And I want to give, we'll give Ken and Elroy a chance coming up next, but just a reminder, we're visiting today with Peter Green, computer consultant with infostar.com. He comes by pretty regularly to help you and I with our personal computer problems here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. For our listeners in the northern part of the state, I'm going to be in Washburn Wisconsin, for a special meet and greet on Thursday, May 15th. That's the night before I'll be broadcasting live from Bayfield in Bloom, in Bayfield, Wisconsin, obviously. But I'll be Thursday night in Washburn with Jennifer Dargan, our assistant director of the Ideas Network at the Washburn Cultural Center. And we'll be there from 6 to 7:30. I've been going to Bayfield for years and years, and Washburn as well. And this year, though, we thought it'd be kind of fun to have a reception, a little bit of a reception. So we have some great food from Coco's. If you're in that area, you know Coco's. We have wines from Wallersheim Winery, and we'll have some door prizes as well. It's going to be a lot of fun. $15, and you can find ticket information on our website. So just go to wpr.org/meetlarry. But don't slash me. I mean, just slash meet Larry. Let's go back to wpr.org/meetlarry. And Jennifer, and have a lot of fun. It's going to be a good time. And it's Thursday, May 15th, Washburn, at the Washburn Cultural Center. And right now, if you have a question for Peter Green, I hope you will call us at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Ken and Elroy has a question. Hi, Ken. Thank you for calling.
Yes. All of us who moved from XP to Windows 7 have found that in using the WordPad accessory to just write a simple letter, you cannot make it single space. And I have tried every suggestion that I have researched on Google. And if some listener or if Pete knows how to make WordPad single space in Windows 7, I would be eternally grateful.
Should be able to do that, Pete.
They screwed it up, Pete.
The only thing I can think of is just playing around with the page setup. WordPad's pretty basic in the features of it. What size font are you using? Maybe that the size of the font is too large.
I have tried every font and every aspect of it, and I've Googled how to make WordPad single space, and there are just an overwhelming number of websites with the same problem, and basically saying that why such a easy to use accessory on XP they turned into a nightmare on Windows 7. So if anybody listening has had that problem and has solved it, please call in.
Man.
I don't know how much they did to WordPad, but maybe you could trick the operating system and go back into the Word, find where the WordPad program is and right mouse click on it and run it in a XP compatibility mode versus in its native Windows 7 mode. And maybe that might trick it to going back.
That's not a bad idea.
I could try that.
Yeah.
Because there are a lot, a lot of programs like Paintbrush, they didn't do anything with Paintbrush.
Yeah.
They just keep bringing it forward. So maybe they did the same thing with WordPad, but because it's running in Windows 7, there's something interacting with it. But if you're telling it, go back and run in XP mode, maybe it might work.
Oh, what a great idea.
I'll try that.
All right. Good luck, Ken. Let us know if that works, will you? That'd be a good thing to know. Good thing to know. Joan in Cuba City. Hi.
Hi, Larry and Peter. I love your show, and this is one of my favorite. Peter's one of my favorite guests that you have on. Anyway, my motherboard fried on my old XP. I've been looking to get a new computer anyway. And luckily, I had just backed up my hard drive to an external hard drive. But anyway, I'm wondering, when I get a new computer, should I have them copy my hard drive to the new computer, or physically transfer the old hard drive. I guess the only thing I'm really worried about is, like, all my email contacts, and I have, you know, like, little folders. I have a small business, so I have, like, customer lists and stuff, and I used Outlook Express before.
Right. Okay. Well, what you can do is you can take that the hard drive from the system that has the fried system board in it. They can take that drive, and once you have, like, if you're going to use Windows 7 or Windows 8, you know, whatever, if you decide to use Windows Live Mail or Outlook, you should be able to import all of those folders into your new email client that you're going to use. So they can get that off of the old hard drive. So I would probably start with the hard drive that's in your system versus the backup first, because that's what you last used.
Right. But you're saying physically transfer the actual hard drive, or have them copy the files to the new?
Copy the files to it. Yeah, so they would probably pull that drive, hook it up to some kind of drive kit to make it functional.
Uh-huh.
And then probably...
I think the hard drive is fine, just the motherboard. But
right, right. Yeah. You're not sure, but you're telling me it sounds like there's probably a pretty good chance.
Yeah.
But anyhow, you know, they would take that drive out. You could physically attach it as a secondary drive and copy it that way, or they could hook it up to a drive kit, which would allow them to use like a USB cable and just read the contents off of that drive.
Okay.
Those are the two ways that I would go about doing it. I would see if I could physically attach it to the computer as a secondary drive and then copy or import whatever you tell me you need done to the new drive, and then you should be all set.
Okay.
There you go. Yeah.
I have one more question if I can.
Okay.
Now, my old computer, the hard drive was getting full. So when I actually bought the external hard drive, figuring I could download stuff to it and then actually delete it from my computer and give me more room on my computer. So I backed up, like, my documents. But then when I went to back it up again, since I had deleted a bunch of stuff from it, I was worried that it would get rid of those things that I had gotten rid of off my computer. So I saved it as, like, my documents 2013. And then I guess I'm wondering, I don't exactly understand how it works when you back something up. Does it just back up the new information that you've added?
It depends.
Now I've totally almost filled up my external hard drive, and what I want to do is start doing it the right way.
Right. Well, if you back up to a new location, you're filling up more of the space on the drive, so you're going to eventually keep eating at it.
Right.
If you use a backup program that allows you to do incremental backups, you typically have one large backup, which is the beginning or the seed, and then after that, you just have little incremental backups. So that, you know, that's the best way to do it. And then if you need to restore something, you simply drill down from prior backups, going back to the date that one of those was made, you know, where you can look for it. But when you start creating different folders or different locations, that's where things start filling up quickly.
Right, and that's what I guess I don't understand exactly how to just back up the little incremental extras.
Depending upon the software that you're using, if it came with the drive, there should be, sometimes they give you like a light version, and then they say, hey, you know, for extra money, you get a premium version, gives you more features. There are other programs out there that will allow you to work with the external drive but give you more control. One of the ones that I use is called Macrium Reflect. It's Macrium Reflect. And what that does is it works just like Apple's Time Machine. You can actually set it up so that it will just make incremental backups, and you can look at your external drive and look at the drive that it backed up, and it'll show you, you know, you can just drill down to each area from your hard drive that it said it backed up, and it will just, you know, show you all the files that you have available if you need to ever do a restore.
Mm-hmm.
And Apple's Time Machine works the same way.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot for calling. And Renee in Oakfield, hi.
Hi.
And you've got a solution for us, maybe?
Maybe. The guy with the WordPad problem with the double spacing?
Yep.
Yep.
I have the problem, too, and after I heard his call, I decided to finally go see if I could figure it out myself. And I think I did. If you go just to the right of the font size, there's four little boxes, and the fourth one over is line spacing. Open that, and it looks like they have, by default, checked to add 10-point space after paragraphs. So, like, when I would type recipes, I would, you know, hit enter after every ingredient, and it would always double space it, and it drove me nuts. Well, now that I unchecked add 10-point space after paragraphs, now it went back to single space like it should be. So that might be...
Oh, sure.
Yep. It sounds like it.
Yep.
So, yep. Yeah, that must be just the default they did. So anyway.
Oh, thank you very much, yep. Renee. I appreciate the... That solution, it was something like that on, I have the same issue on in my Apple. There's the, I have to go to paragraph, and the line spacing in paragraph, it defaults to 10 for some reason, and I have to change it to 0. So, and then it goes single space. So it's very similar. Well, Peter Green is our guest today. Yeah, he's a computer consultant with Infostar.com. He'll be with us right up until 12:30. We'll take a look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net, and then we will be back with Peter. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. We're taking a look at your computer and your software with Peter Green of Infostar.com. Pete, great to have you with us. Thanks so much for taking time to be with us today.
Always great, Larry.
And as always, you have brought a top 10 list, places for us to go online to look at interesting stuff.
Yep, and it never ceases to amaze me. I say it so many times, how many cool things are out there that have been created for us to use and learn and, you know, make things work better for us.
What do you got for us?
So if you go to the current or the archives and scroll down, excuse me, to today's date, the first one is called goldcalc.com, and it's an online scrap gold calculator based on current gold prices.
Hmm.
So that's could be useful for some people. And I don't know if I said they're all. So if you go to infostar.com, that's where they're all located. Number two, askapatient.com, and it's to learn from the experience of people who have taken drug treatments, and you share side effects and success stories. Number three is Live Fire, and it's LiveFyre.com, and it's a company that helps companies to engage consumers through a combination of what they say real-time conversation and social curation and social advertising. So, it's just another way of companies trying to support, you know, the products and services that they sell. Number four is digitalspy.com, just like it sounds, and it's a news and info resource for technology, games, movies, TVs, and more. And like I mentioned earlier, this next one is called Power of Wind, and it's a resource that covers the wind power energy technology industry. The next one is wallstreetcheatsheet.com. It's W-A-L, and then it's S-T for street, and then cheatsheet.com. And it's a financial news for investing, and it covers a wide variety of topics. I don't know if we ever talked about this car before, Larry. I'm sure you did on your hybrid show, maybe. Tesla Motors.
Yeah.
You know, they keep coming out with more and more models. It's a premium electric car manufacturer. It's pretty pricey product, but very interesting. And you know, if you want to check out all the things that they make, that's a site to go to. And then an automotive industry news and review resource is called topspeed.com. And then another resource for looking for help with the Windows operating system is called windowsanswers.net. And the last one is a resource that tries to help people who are injured by dangerous drug and medical devices. So you know, those ads you see on TV where they're typically by lawyers looking to, you know, have lawsuits against some company.
Yeah.
This is called drugwatch.com. So you can find additional background information about the drugs and the medical devices that might, you know, have a factor in either you or a loved one that was affected by it. So it might be a good resource to check out.
All those on Infostar.com, upper left corner of the page.
Yep, current or the archives.
Or the archives. There's a lot of them.
Yeah, we're approaching 200.
I was going to say, it has to be close to a couple hundred in there.
Yeah.
Pretty cool. You know, Susan in Wausau has a question for you, so let's go there. Susan, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello. This is pretty simple, maybe. I have an iPhone and iPad, and I keep recently in the last probably month, when I turn them on, there's a note saying I need to maybe consider having more iCloud storage space. And I'm kind of cheap and don't think I really want to do that. If I can somehow clean up my iPad and my phone a little bit, I have a certain number a fair number of photos, which I've considered just trying to just put them on our hard drive and our computer and eliminating most of them on my phone. I have a lot of email addresses, of course, and phone numbers. Do you know what are the things that really seem to take up the most storage if I was going to start cleaning it up?
That'd be one.
Yep, it's going to be pictures, videos, and music.
Audio.
Yep. So
and audio?
What you can do, and what you can do is if you look at your phone, if your pad is also hooked up to cloud backup, typically you're going to have just one account for both of those. But you can go into the cloud settings and see what you're actually backing up. You can specify the areas that you're backing up, and if it'll give you kind of an amount that you're using, and how much is free. You know how much space you have. So if you have a lot of pictures on there, you're probably going to want to back them up to your hard drive. Through your backups or transferring them over so you know where they are. And then you might want to consider deleting some of them off of your devices, and that'll probably save you some space.
Can I ask you another question? I'm on my iCloud account, and it doesn't really show me how much. It just says they're on. Is there a way to find out how much is on each one of them? Or
for each one? That would probably be in your... If you're logged into it, there should be an area that should show you those details. On the actual phone itself, you would click into the iCloud, and you can switch on or off the different areas. And then it tells you, then there's another link for storage and backup, and it has a link for the total amount of storage, what's available, and to manage your storage.
Okay.
So... And then you can change it from the actual device that you're using, you know, you're backing up using the iCloud backup.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
I think that's it. If I have any other questions, I'll call you back.
Okay. Thanks, Susan. Thank you for calling. And Ken from Elroy called back. He was the fellow that had the spacing problem.
Yep.
He was still listening, and when he heard that fix, he tried it, and it worked perfectly.
Oh, excellent.
Excellent.
That's the way this is supposed to work, Larry.
Yeah, it's great. You know, you can't have every answer off the top of your head.
Yeah, there's so many applications, operating system permutations of computers and, you know, web and internet and all that stuff that it's really helping each other. And like I said, you're typically not the only person out there that's having a problem or an experience.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Peter in Stoughton has a question for you. Hi, Peter.
Good afternoon. The gentleman who called before, who is still running XP and wondering about alternatives for that, if he is still running XP, he might want to consider getting a new computer, and I don't work for Hewlett-Packard or anything like that, but Hewlett-Packard does still sell good laptops and desktops that come preloaded with Windows 7. So that might be an easier transition for him to make than to try and learn an operating system all over again.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, Larry, one thing I left out, and I still I have the link up on my when you go to the top 10, is the Classic Shell, which basically you download. It's free. And I believe Windows did this in their Windows 8.1 upgrade, is to allow you to have a different user interface, more of the classic look of Windows 7 versus the 8. The Windows 8 was developed really a lot for the touchscreen technology in the tablet.
Yeah.
But you can download this program, Classic Shell, for free, and it will allow you to pick and choose how you want to interact with the operating system. And I believe there's like an XP look to it and a Windows 7 look to it. So they're very similar.
Yeah. Thanks, Peter. Appreciate the call. And Mike in Castle Rock, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Good morning. Hi. I live in the deep country, and we have dial-up here. Now, but there are quite a few people that are hooked up to the Internet. What happens is, for instance, you're opening up eBay. It'll show that it's opening up, and then the screen will kind of freeze for 10 or 15 seconds, or maybe not at all. But if you refresh it, then it pops right in. So is that common with dial-up?
There's probably some kind of lag going on where you're seeing that delay. And the Internet protocol uses error correction when the two sides are communicating with each other. So when you use dial-up, there's with all the stuff that's going on with today's, you know, web pages and the complexity of them, there's a lot more that is being thrown back and forth between the two, a lot of chatter. So it typically creates more delay. And that's why, you know, the broadband connections, you know, performance is a lot better.
Well, is this something that is correctable by the ISP, or is it they're not going to, you know, waste time doing it?
It would be the best way to correct it would probably be with a computer that had a good amount of memory in it to allow caching, more caching of pages and information coming down from the Internet.
Yeah.
So are you saying that I could upgrade the memory just by another chip, and that would improve things?
Do you know what your system has right now? Any idea?
I don't. It came with something, and it was if I said it was 2 gigabytes or something, I wouldn't know.
How old would you say your system is?
4 years old.
Yeah, I would probably gather that you're probably in the two gig.
Yeah.
If you doubled it to 4, it would probably help. Which operating system are you using?
Well, I'm using Safari.
Safari. Yeah, it would probably help.
Yeah.
That usually cures a lot of problems with that.
It's not too expensive either, is it?
No.
No,
nope. I just doubled the memory on my MacBook, and I did it because the price was right.
Yeah. Yep, there you go, Mike. Good luck. Thank you for calling. I want to give Bud in Milwaukee a chance to join us. Bud, hello.
How you doing today?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Hey, got tired of Windows and when XP died off, like end of life did. I went to Ubuntu. Mm-hmm. Ubuntu. Do you know anything about that operating system?
Do I know? What do you need to know?
Well, I loaded it and I was able to keep my Windows partition, so all my old files and things, pictures and things are still available. I mean, but it seems too good to be true. You know, it's like, it's free, but is it secure? Mm-hmm. You know, am I going to have issues with it but not know about it?
Well, no. I mean, it works. It to me, it's just another, you know, user interface to using the computer. The most important thing, I've said this back, Larry, when Windows didn't even exist, you know, what are you using the computer for? Find the software and then the hardware. And the hardware needs the operating system to allow you to use the software that you've chosen to do the tasks that you need done. Not trying to be complicated, but if the things that you do our email, web, you know, looking, maybe editing or looking at pictures, video, music. You don't have any bookkeeping things that you do or any, you know, crazy software that you need. Ubuntu or any other version of Linux operating system is going to work because you're not doing something that's complicated. But if you're needing to do tasks like using Adobe Creative Suite and InDesign or Photoshop or Illustrator, you're limited by what operating system is supported, and you're not going to find a version of that software through Ubuntu or other Linux programs.
Right.
But you may find an alternative
GIMP
to the Creative Suite products that work on those operating systems, Ubuntu and Linux. But you're probably going to be more on your own trying to learn how to get them to do what you need done versus the support that's out there for the more popular programs.
Okay. So yeah, I'm good to go then.
Yeah.
So it really boils down to your comfort level, you know, in terms of if Ubuntu has what you need and it works well, it can coexist. You can have 3-4 different OSs on a computer and just pick which one you want to use.
Yeah. There you go, bud. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call.
It's a great question.
Yeah, just another operating system.
Yep.
Rex in Milwaukee, hello. Rex, are you there?
Oh. I had a question on a my keyboard is no longer functioning on my Windows 8 Asus machine. That's a desktop.
Okay. How do you troubleshoot?
Yeah, I've been troubleshooting it per instructions with several people. So if it's not a problem you're familiar with, I don't want to waste your time. But I thought
No, is it somewhere that some of the keys are not working, or is it just functionally not no longer communicating with the computer?
Well, what's funny is I can log in with it,
uh-huh.
and it'll accept my login, but as soon as I open up a program where it requires a text or a number, mm-hmm. I'll hear a click on my speaker, but there will be no printing of any letter or any other figure.
Well, is it hooked up wireless, or is it hooked up through USB, or is it hooked up through the keyboard connector to the computer?
It's direct connected USB. I have tried. I've got 4 other keyboards here. It happened about 3 weeks ago, about the time of that update that they sent down, the big one.
Hmm.
So you've tried 4 keyboards?
Yeah.
And it's all the same?
Yeah, also I got the on-screen keyboard, mm-hmm. and that's how I've been functioning using it. It does work.
But you're telling me that you physically have 4 different keyboards, and they all have the same problem?
Yep.
Wow, that's unusual.
Well, that doesn't sound like it's a keyboard. I don't think it's a keyboard.
I don't think it's a keyboard. I think it's software-related.
Well, it's actually... The way the computer communicates between the keyboard and the computer is firmware, and I would probably contact the manufacturer, and they might have a firmware upgrade for your system board, which may actually, you know, fix that problem. But having 4 keyboards and they're all having the same problem makes me suspect there's something going on with the actual system board and firmware itself.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that info.
Yeah, give it a shot.
If you need details on your computer, there's a utility. There's Belarc Advisor, BELARC Advisor, and I don't know how to pronounce it, but it's SPECCBV or something.
Mm.
But Belarc Advisor, they'll tell you all the details about your computer.
Thanks, Rex. Tim in Wales. Hello.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good, thanks for calling.
Hey, I have 2 Windows 8 machines. They talk to a wireless router, and I have a hard drive plugged into the wireless router. Now, they can see the drive, but they can't access the file. They can't get any farther in than seeing it. Now, I can see it with, and I can look at the files with with an Ubuntu different machine. So I don't know if this is a home group problem or it is, but how do I set this up?
Okay, number one, if you want computers to communicate with each other, in the computer information, there's an area that you, a work group, and they need to be set the same. By default, it might be already the same. So that's one thing. And then for the drive, or typically I tell people not to share a drive but share a folder. So you may want to call the folder share or, you know, whatever you want to call it. But you right mouse click on it, and you are going to manage the sharing of that folder. So you can, you know, share it to everybody, or you can share it to an individual user. But you need to share it in order for other people to have access to it, or the other system to have access to it. Once that's done, most of the time I tell people to reboot it, because then the file permissions will be changed, the sharing permissions will be changed, and everything comes up, and that, you know, that's the way it should be. And then if you want to make it so that you have access to that shared drive on a regular basis, you can right mouse click on your computer, and it will come up with one of the things it'll say is map network drive, and then you can simply assign a drive letter and then locate that shared folder on the other computer.
And there, well, there, the difficulty is accessing it from the beginning, because it's, you know, when I plug it in, I can't do anything with it other than see it from either one of those machines.
Well, that's where you have to set the sharing. You know, if you can, if you see the drive or see the folder, and you right mouse click on it, that's where you have to set up the share parameters.
Okay.
You can't do anything from another computer until those things have actually been set up and you have permission to do that.
There you go. Good luck, Tim.
So it's a logical order of, one, where is the shared drive that you want to set up? Number two, set up for being shared. Then the computer knows it's to be shared and who to share it to. And then when you reboot it and all the you're making sure all the permissions and parameters have been set, then the other system, as long as it's a member of the same work group, can then have access to that. And then you map that shared folder or drive to the computer that you're trying to, you know, get to it from.
And thank you very much again, Tim, for calling. And Pete, thank you so much.
Always great, Larry.
Yeah, take care of that back, will you?
Yep, by the time I see you next time, hopefully I'll be jogging a little.
All right, that sounds good, Pete. Thanks again.
Yep, thank you.
Peter Green of InfoStar.com will be back in a month, and hopefully, you know, he's recovering from his back surgery. He did a great job today, as a matter of fact, answering the questions. I really appreciate him taking the time. Just a reminder, Thursday, May 15th, I'll be in Washburn for a meet and greet along with Jennifer Dargan at the Washburn Cultural Center. Be there from 6 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. You are invited. Lots of food and drink. Go to WPR.org/meetLarry to sign up. That's next week, Thursday. Tomorrow we'll take a look at research on Alzheimer's, and there's a new book out called No Saints Around Here, A Caregiver's Days. Thanks for listening. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.